This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with restaurants and big changes coming. Proof of vaccination coming to the city of Boston starting on January 15th. Adults will have to show proof of one vaccine shot to enter restaurants, entertainment venues, fitness centers in Boston. February 15, that requirement goes up to two shots. The same requirement will apply to children starting in March. That is a lot for restaurants to implement at the door. Meanwhile, Omicron, dominant strain in Massachusetts, cases and hospitalizations continue to climb. That will affect people's dining behavior as well. This is an industry that has struggled to weather this pandemic for nearly 2 years already. Now, coming up in a couple of minutes, we will check in with two restaurateurs as they head into another pandemic winter, and we'll take your calls. What restaurants are you supporting in this pandemic? Who are you trying to keep open? Why? Why is it important to you to support them? Give us a call. Give them a shout out. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We will get there. But first, we want to get a sense of how the business community as a whole is handling this new proof of vaccine mandate and what it means for them. We're going to talk here now to Greg Ryan, senior reporter with the Boston Business Journal. Greg, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So we are focused mostly today on restaurants, Greg, but entertainment venues, gyms also getting this requirement that you have to require proof of vaccination. It's a big step. What are you hearing from the businesses who will be impacted by this?
Yeah, I've been speaking with restaurant owners and owners of other types of businesses that will be impacted, and it's really the reaction has been really divided. I think one common theme has been there's been some anxiety about the enforcement angle, you know, requiring staff to sometimes confront people who aren't presenting, you know, vaccination records and still want to come into a restaurant. So that's certainly a concern. But it really depends on who you talk to. You know, I spoke to one restaurant owner who said, this is great. This is going to make my staff feel safer, knowing that everyone that's coming into the restaurant is vaccinated. Hung up the phone, called another restaurant owner. And he said, you know, I don't really know what this is going to do. I mean, I'm hearing on the news there are all these breakthrough cases with Omicron, the Omicron variant. I'm not really sure what this is going to mean for my staff.
Are you hearing from any restaurant owners, I've been hanging on by a thread, one more thing that keeps a patron out of my door and it pushes me over the edge?
Yeah, certainly. I certainly have heard that. You know, staffing is a huge issue across industries, but especially for restaurants, finding enough staff every night. And, you know, so some restaurant owners, they have employees who aren't vaccinated. Most I have spoken with, most employees are vaccinated. They might have one or two in a restaurant that aren't. But if you have to get rid of one or two people, because this policy applies to employees too, remember. So if you have to get rid of those people, it's going to make a difference.
So Boston's the first, but there are a number of other communities, as I understand it, looking to follow suit pretty quickly. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so Boston Mayor Michelle Wu came out on Tuesday with a detailed plan, including the timeline you outlined. But a number of other cities and towns, including Cambridge, Somerville, Brookline, Salem, they've indicated they're going to be announcing similar plans. And other places have said, okay, not right now, but this may be something we consider down the road, depending on how things go with Omicron.
So I know the press conference was on Monday. She had mayors like Joe Curtatone of Somerville there, Kim Driscoll of Salem, supporting some of these measures. So does it feel like we are headed in a regional direction, Greg?
I think so, although I think even in greater Boston, it's not going to be universal. I think a lot of the largest cities and towns are already on board, but, you know, some aren't. I know Newton, some people were looking to Newton in particular to see what they would do, but you know, so far Newton is in that category of wait and see. So it will be a bit patchwork even in greater Boston.
And what are you waiting and seeing on? What are you watching for next in your reporting?
One thing I think, and this is a little bit down the road, but one thing I'm particularly interested to see is the effect on those businesses that cater to families and children. I spoke with the CEO of the Boston Children's Museum. Children over five who are eligible for the vaccine are going to have to be vaccinated by, at least have one dose of the vaccine by March 1st. The uptake for kids 5 to 12 in terms of getting vaccinated has lagged behind adults in Massachusetts. The majority of kids 5 to 12 have not received a vaccine dose yet. So it'll be, I think some parents, even if they themselves are vaccinated, are a little bit weary about doing the same for their kids. So it'll be interesting to see what the effect on those types of businesses will be come March.
All right. We will watch too. Greg Ryan, senior reporter with the Boston Business Journal. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
I'm actually going to go to the phones real quick. We are taking your calls at 800-423-8255 as we focus on restaurants. Who are you trying to help keep open? Who are you making sure to patronize in your community during this pandemic and why? We've got Carrie on the line in Cambridge. Carrie, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm the owner of Grendel's Den, and so I am very much supporting Grendel's Den staying in business. And to that end, we've actually been requiring vaccination from our patrons who wish to dine indoors ever since May.
So, Carrie, this feels like a move that comes in line for you, even though it's Boston, you're Cambridge. Would you like to see this as a regional approach?
I think it's smart for restaurants to do best practices like this, but we really do need some help from the, we do need some support to do it properly. One of the challenges really is when we have people needing booster shots, and if that becomes a requirement, I got to tell you, the math is really tough. I mean, you're looking at three different dates. Are they 6 months apart? Are they on time for their vaccine? I mean, you really need a calculator here, and this is a lot to ask of somebody who's usually, you know, a doorman or a host, which is typically sort of an entry-level position. So you're dealing with trying to get this kind of staff to be an expert in, vaccination policy, and really, it's a complicated calendar. It's a lot more must be born than born before this date.
Well, Carrie, owner of Grendel's Den in Cambridge, I'm glad you called, added your voice to this conversation. Appreciate it, and good luck. So keep calling. Let us know who you're supporting. Your favorite spots from the corner deli to fine dining. Are you eating in? Are you eating out? Who are you trying to support? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK or tweet us at Radio Boston. Two guests joining us now. Nancy Caswell is president of the group Massachusetts Restaurants United and owner of Brine in Newburyport and Oak and Rowan. Also with us is Emma Hollander, managing partner at the Starlight Management Company, which owns restaurants in Somerville, Cambridge, Newburyport, Plum Island. That includes Trina's Starlight Lounge, Parlor Sports, Audubon Bar, and the new Sunset Club on Plum Island. Nancy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for speaking on this super important topic.
I'm glad to have you. And Emma, welcome to you, too.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Emma, I'm going to start with you real quick. I am mindful we're having this conversation at this moment of time, but next calendar year, which is just really a few days away now, we will be entering the third calendar year affected by this pandemic, second pandemic winter. How are you faring? How are your staff faring? How's it going?
I think that everybody's nervous. This was not the direction we thought we were going to be going in. And I think until recently, in the past couple weeks, everybody really started getting scared that, what winter holds as the new variant is kind of whipping itself around the city. Business increased in October, and it seemed like things were going in the right direction. And I think at this point, everybody's just really, really nervous about what winter holds for us and the entire restaurant community.
Emma, can you take us to that moment? You said you thought things were going in a different direction, right? Business is up in October, feeling like we're crawling our way out of this. And then, right? So take me to the moment where you thought, oh, no, we might be swinging back the other way.
I would say it was probably 2 or 3 weeks ago when Omicron became very prominent, and especially in the restaurant community, we all are very close. And I think that business was great for October and November. And as soon as the pandemic really started, you know, knocking people out again, people were testing positive all over the city. Restaurants are starting to shut down again because they have too many positive cases in the, you know, within the business to even stay open and operational. That from a financial and safety aspect of it, especially people that, you know, don't get paid if they don't go to work, or don't get paid if people don't come in, it's really terrifying.
Nancy, what was that moment for you, that oh no?
I would say similar timeline to Emma, with sales revenue kind of coming up. And then the reality kind of hit for us, I think, about 2 weeks ago, specifically in the city, where, you know, I think a lot of companies in our neighborhood in Portport, Seaport, were thinking about, you know, how to celebrate the holidays with employees. And we were starting to see these small group gatherings, you know, nothing really more than like 15 or 20 people. And in the last 2 weeks or so, we felt like everything was starting to cancel, to the point that even last week, almost all of the holiday parties that were booked were canceling and seeing if they could push them out.
And are you seeing increased worry about contagion within your workforce as well?
Well, I think that's the scary part about Omicron. It seems to be so contagious and so fast spreading. That's the biggest challenge right now is, you know, once you're seeing a positive or an exposure, the chance that, you know, four or five people are exposed within the operation is a lot more quicker than where it was with Delta, or, you know, even at the initial engagement back in, you know, March 2020.
Let's go to the phones. 800-423-8255 as we speak with Nancy Caswell, president of the group Massachusetts Restaurants United, and Emma Hollander, managing partner at the Starlight Management Company. We've got Joseph on the line in Amherst. Joseph, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have two quick ones. One is, why aren't we allowing for people who have had COVID as a natural immunity, which all the major studies have been done, including a massive one in Israel, indicate are just as good as having the vaccine? Why aren't we paying attention to that? And the other thing is, this is really madness. We're turning frontline customer service employees into the vaccine police. And as your guest mentioned earlier, in terms of like, are we going to be calculating, oh, I'm sorry, it's only been 5 months and 12 days since, or 6 months and 2 days since you had your booster. Are we really thinking that frontline customer service employees are the people that we should be employing for this?
All right. Thank you for that, Joseph. I'm going to take it back now. The first part of Joseph's call, we addressed this on Ask the Doctors yesterday. I'm not going to go through all of the fact-checking, but Joseph's not correct. The Israel study, that's something different. I don't know. Telling you straight up. But the rest of that, not correct. However, Emma, I am interested in this question of the strain and stress of frontline employees, workers in restaurants, now having to essentially police this. Talk about that.
It is stressful. I mean, we as restaurant employees, we do take a lot of responsibility for what happens in every aspect of the restaurant. So our guest safety is always the most important thing in our business. And if checking somebody's vaccine card is going to be the thing that keeps our staff and our guests safe, then that's what we're going to do. You know, we also take liability with serving alcohol. We take liability with checking IDs to make sure that, you know, people aren't underage and drinking. We take liability in making sure that everybody feels comfortable when they're in the building. So, yes, this is stressful, but it's even more stressful to not know if everybody that you're in contact with is being safe and is vaccinated.
So, go ahead. I didn't know you weren't done. Go for it.
I think, honestly, it is a stressful aspect of everybody having to check vaccine cards. But the most stressful thing is working in a restaurant where you're putting your own life at risk.
Yeah. Nancy, I was thinking about this. I was driving the other day, came to a four-way stop and thought, well, we can't have a police officer police every single four-way stop sign in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. We have to rely on each other to collaborate, to say it is unsafe if I drive through that stop sign when it's not my turn. It does seem like we can't be asking our restaurants to police this. We need to be asking people to voluntarily cooperate to keep each other safe. How good as citizens are your customers being to each other and your staff?
You know, I would say as a restaurant owner, you're always focused on the negative, right? I mean, like every negative Yelp review, anytime somebody says something that they, you know, disappointed in an experience, you seem to focus on that. And I would say that maybe, you know, out of, you know, two dozen, maybe a one guest is frustrated by, you know, the request for even a mask. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that in the end, when you're in our industry, we are training our employees to be hospitable, to be gracious. Yes, absolutely, we can do that for you. You know, we never train these individuals to just say no. And since the beginning of this pandemic, our frontline workers have had to do that. You know, no, we can't serve you. No, you need to keep your mask on. No, you can't do this, right? And it's been exhausting for sure. I think that this step, when it comes to an ID and vaccination or a picture of your vaccination, it's going to be a hurdle. And we totally understand that. And part of MRU's desire to be at the table with Michelle Wu was to be able to give her maybe some direction on how we're feeling about it and how we potentially think we can execute it. You know, our industry is very much, you know, led by the Board of Health. And so if public health is saying and our leadership is saying vaccinations are the next step, the only thing we can do is just try to have a seat at the table and be able to educate and try to get these individuals to understand how it's going to work in our restaurants. And not all of our answer, not all of our questions have been answered, and we're going to continue to do the work to try to get these answers.
So I want to grab a couple of shout outs, excuse me, from listeners now, 800-423-8255. Karen's on the line in Brookline. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much. Landwehr Cafe is my go-to, whether I'm eating in, I'm dining out, I'm taking takeout. I feel safe there. I love the menu. And if I can't travel to Israel now, at least I can go up to Cleveland Circle or Audubon Circle, where there are two locations. Gotta love Landwehr Cafe.
So they're the ones you're trying to help stay open. Excellent. Thanks, Karen. Daryl, how about you? Daryl's in Lincoln.
Yes, Uncle Chung's in Framingham. I have celiac disease. I have kids with all kinds of allergies and a father with that had high blood pressure, and they do a great job of like catering to those, you know, with those kind of issues with gluten-free food and fantastic quality. So we go there every week to try to support them, keep them moving.
Dine in or carry out, Daryl?
Mostly carry out now.
All right. Thank you very much. So listeners, who are you trying to help stay open? 1-800-423-8255. Are you dining in? Are you carrying out? Is that changing again as the COVID and Omicron landscape changes around us? So Emma, I'm going to come back to you here. You know, in getting ready to talk to you guys today, I was just thinking so much about how hard it must have been already. I can't imagine what it's like to have not only your own livelihood on the line, but the livelihood of all your employees as well. 2 years into this, staffing shortages, inflation, supply shortages, how hard is it to stay open?
I feel like that's kind of a trick question. It has been exhausting. Once the vaccine rollout happened, there really was this light at the end of the tunnel. You know, we were fully staffed. Our staff was fully vaccinated. Once that happened, we really thought that we were on the up and up. And again, you know, business was great. People, once they were vaccinated, were feeling comfortable about going out again. It's incredibly frustrating to feel like we're back at the beginning, but we're 2 years into this. At this point, you know, there's no giving up. We've already been through this before. You know, we've already gone through a pandemic winter. We know what we need to do to stay open. We know what works and what doesn't work. We know that, you know, we're a neighborhood spot and people are going to order takeout and they're going to fight to make sure their neighborhood restaurants stay open. But now more than ever, with, you know, government funding not necessarily coming back to help us, we need the help of our community in order to stay open. We can't do it without every single person fighting for independently owned restaurants.
And Nancy, I'm picking up on a couple of things Emma said there. If a restaurant, for example, has not at this point learned how to pivot or been able to, maybe because of the nature of their food or their service or the type of restaurant, been able to pivot to takeout, is it too late? Can they do that now? Can they change the menu? Is it an imperative in this next pandemic winter we're entering now?
Well, I think we've been pretty resilient. And honestly, I think that's the difference between how we're handling Omicron and where we're going into this third year, as opposed to where we started. I think we've learned a lot about ourselves as operators, and we've established, you know, this team that is, you know, again, resilient and strong and willing to do what it takes. And I think that ghost kitchens and conceptually creating menus that are more geared towards takeout has been something that people now realize, like, I can do, and maybe even grown from those concepts and has started to establish them already within their, you know, four walls and their brick and mortar. So I do think there's potential there, but I will say, you know, federal aid, the initial request to replenish the RR to fill the RRF, back when it was first provided to us through the SBA, the number was a real number, and it was shorted. And obviously, because it was shorted, many people that applied were shorted as well.
And I'm sorry, so just explain really, for our listeners, and honestly for me, to make sure I understand what you're saying, what does shorted mean?
So the RRF initially, so this is a replenishment, a restaurant revitalization fund that was put in place and established between several different legislators, as well as national organizations like the National Restaurant Association, Independent Restaurant Coalition, that came together during the pandemic. And the idea was that we would, you know, get money into certain restaurant groups, structures, you know, smaller than large corporate. And the applications went through, and I think they honored about 60 billion of it, but they left roughly about 46 billion out there.
Okay, thanks for that. All right, I'm going to go back to the phones at least one more time here. Elias on the line in Brookline. Elias, go ahead.
Hey there, just wanted to pass on our support for Audubon Bar. Actually, it was great to hear Emma on there, and Jay, Sergio, Riley, everybody over there has been supporting us through the pandemic with Taco Tuesdays, and ever since my wife and I actually went on our first date there back in 2016.
Okay, that you warmed my heart, even if you didn't warm Emma's, and I bet you did. Elias, Emma, how does it feel to hear that?
That's very sweet. Thank you so much for your support. We couldn't do any of it without people like you.
All right, let's hear from one more. We've got Joan in Cambridge. Go ahead, Joan.
I want to do a shout out for Juliet. You know, when the pandemic first hit, they were very creative. They tried to do Zooms. They're wonderful cooks and great bakers.
It's great to have that shout out too. Thanks. So Joan giving a shout to Juliet in Somerville. All right. So coming back to you, Nancy and Emma, what do you need next? Right. So many communities, several are preparing now to follow suit, taking votes to follow suit with Boston potentially having proof of vaccination. The governor has said no statewide mask mandate, but is advising people to wear masks indoors. Vaccines, boosters, test kits coming from the federal government at home. What's the most important next thing, just briefly, for you, Emma?
Money.
All right, then.
I mean, we need support. You know, we need to be supported through the winter. Our staff needs to be supported. Our undocumented immigrants who don't receive government assistance need to be supportive. Our servers and bartenders that make $3 an hour need to be supported. There's a lot that goes into what the restaurant industry is and what it takes to operate a restaurant, you know, throughout a winter. And if people don't feel comfortable coming into our establishment and we're not making any money, our staff isn't making any money. So we need to be supported through the winter. And that doesn't mean just, you know, loans to independent restaurants. That means supporting every employee that works in the restaurant organization and community as a whole.
All right, we're going to make that the drop the mic moment. That is Emma Hollander, their managing partner of the Starlight Management Company, along with Nancy Caswell, president of the group Massachusetts Restaurants United and owner of Brine and Oak and Rowan. Emma, Nancy, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The MBTA is cutting back service on several bus lines starting this Sunday due to driver shortages. And then this week, video released from the horrible escalator accident at Back Bay Station in September, which reminds us, honestly, once again that we have the oldest subway infrastructure in the country. We need the T to keep us moving, even though fewer people want to take it during this pandemic and now Omicron, which means there is a lot to talk about with MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek, and he will take your calls. Do you have a question about the service cutbacks? What do you need to know about, let's say, mask safety on buses and trains? Are you using the T? What do you want him to know about your experience? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. MBTA General Manager Steve Poftek, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Steve, I want to kind of get the nuts and bolts out first. Remind folks which lines will be affected by service cuts. How big are these cuts, and why did you have to do them?
Sure. There'll be no impact on the subway system or subway schedules. In fact, we are adding a little bit of weekend service in the evenings on the Mattapan line. The service cuts, which I encourage you to take a look at mbta.com, it will affect many of the bus lines. They will be incremental service cuts. So what folks will see is a slight stretching out of the time in between buses. What this allows us to do is what has been happening now is when we don't have an employee to do a particular run, we drop the trip so that there's a real long irregular gap at times between buses. What this will allow us to do is smooth that out a bit and have service be more predictable. You asked why we're doing this. We're doing this purely because we are having a difficult time attracting people to become bus operators at the T. This is not the direction we want to go in. And in fact, we are fully funded to provide a much higher level of service, and we are actively hiring right now. So if anyone listening is interested, again, I direct you to mbta.com and take a look at our open positions, including hundreds of bus operator positions.
Steve, that's got to be maddening. Did it drive you nuts to have to cut back service, especially during the pandemic when you want riders back on the T?
Absolutely. We do not want to be in this position, but I think we are dealing not only with a national issue of, you know, overall shortage in the workforce, but surely in transportation, we have seen shortages. We've seen BPS, struggle to make sure that their bus service is fully staffed. I know our friends out at the regional transportation authorities across the Commonwealth are dealing with similar issues. Everyone is struggling to attract workers right now, and we are looking at every possible option to try to get more people to understand what an opportunity it is to be a bus driver at the MBTA, to apply, and to make sure that they get trained and get behind the wheel of a bus.
When you first announced the shortages and the pending service cuts, I know there were critics out there saying, hey, you need to put in place more incentives, et cetera. You've done some of that now. Do you feel if you'd done that sooner, it would have helped with your pipeline?
Probably anything we could have done sooner would have been better. We're doing a lot of it now. We're going to be in the new year. We are going to be offering bonuses. We are working to, a lot of what we've done now is outreach. We're doing a massive advertising campaign. We've also worked with our friends at the RMV to notify anyone with a commercial driver's license has been made aware that the MBTA is hiring. So we're really trying to push those numbers up. And we have a pretty aggressive plan. We would love to be adding back service and love to be in that position soon.
I want to talk about Omicron for a minute. One of the pieces of data about Omicron that still kind of haunts me is that it replicates in the respiratory tract in the airways 70 times faster than the previous variant, Delta. Before the break, we were talking to restaurant owners about the challenges of having restaurant employees enforcing something like now you have to show in the city of Boston in January proof of vaccination to come into the restaurant, that it's important for people to cooperate voluntarily. I'm thinking about masks. And mask cooperation on public transit with Omicron hanging over us the way it is. How well are people doing masking up? How much do you wish you could enforce that? And talk to people right now. They're listening. What do you want to tell them about safety on the T?
I mean, I guess I start with asking everyone to please wear your mask on the MBTA in an MBTA facilities. It is a federal requirement. It's the right thing to do for yourself, your fellow passengers, and T employees. We are seeing a very good level of compliance by folks on the T. We've attempted to take what I would call a supportive approach. In many cases, we've had transit ambassadors in major stations who have masks that they've been able to give out. You know, we've tried to view this more as a sort of giving people the supportive message, please wear your mask. If you need a mask, when we have one available, we'll provide it, as opposed to turning each one of these incidents into a police matter. But we
have, by and large, seen
good compliance.
Yeah, do you have any data on that about, I mean, I'm imagining you compare notes with transit systems around the country. Do we know, does the carrot, the soft, the helpful approach work better on overall mask compliance than the stick?
We think it does. I mean, I don't know that there's anyone who's doing, to use your term, you know, sort of the stick approach. We do regular audits of our employees and of overall mask wearing. I say, you know, in general, I think we've seen about 95% compliance, and then some of the non-compliance, or some of that, you know, some of that number is folks who are wearing a mask but perhaps wearing it incorrectly. We have an extensive Ride Safer campaign, which you'll see on posters and on our message boards, explaining to folks how to properly wear a mask and urging people to wear a mask.
I'm going to put the phone number out here again, 1-800-423-8255, to ask MBTA General Manager Steve Pofdek a question. We've got Bill on the line in Newton. Bill, briefly, what's your question?
I just had a question. If he realized that they had more retired employees than working employees, and if that has contributed to them not being able to have enough drivers.
Steve.
I am aware of that. I think, you know, part of that, which, you know, folks in your audience may or may not know, is up until if you started working at the MBTA before 2012, your retirement system is based on your years of service, and the required years of service were 23 years, and then you were eligible for retirement. So as a consequence, we have a number of employees who I think would be considered mid-career by most estimates, who are then eligible to retire. So that is, an incentive for folks to retire. We have thought about possibly bringing retirees back. I know other systems have done it and have not seen that be sort of the solution to the employee shortage. But it is, as I said, you know, everything is on the table. It is something that we are considering.
I'm thinking about the video that came out this week. We talked to you after the Back Bay Station accident, the escalator accident. I know you know the Boston Globe had an article this week looking at history of escalator accidents. We've also talked a lot, Steve, since you took the job and since I took this job, about infrastructure and capital repairs. Do you know any more about what happened in September? And just talk to me about these challenges of infrastructure, safety, and getting the money you need to get stuff fixed.
Sure. I don't have any additional information to share. Part of that is because there is ongoing litigation, so I'm really limited in what I can say. It's also because we had a pause in the investigation while some of these legal issues were worked out. But this, you know, this one is particularly frustrating. You know, a careful read of that Globe article, this escalator had passed inspection. It had been regularly maintained with a rigorous maintenance regime. So obviously, we want to understand that. To answer your question more broadly, the MBTA needs investment, and it's getting that investment. We are up, you know, we are close to $2 billion a year in investment. You know, we just reviewed internally, at least our preliminary 5-year plan that we'll be developing over the next 6 months. We're going to sustain that level of investment, and that is, you know, that's roughly 5 times what we were investing per year in the system a decade ago, but it's going to take that sustained level of investment over a number of years to address all of these things. And I think, you know, I'm hopeful that folks see some of the green shoots, like, you know, the new trains on the Orange Line, but then you see the old cars on the Orange Line and you realize that we still have a ways to go. And, you know, that is our ongoing work to maintain this level of investment.
Let's break in there for a second. I won't go to Chris from JP just because we're tight on time, but Chris from JP was calling specifically to ask the status of the Orange Line replacement train. So let's answer his question, Steve.
Sure. Right now, on any given day, we typically three of the 14 trains in at the peak in the rush hour are the new trains. We are expecting in the new year a significant number of new trains. We are getting a regular flow of cars for the Orange Line from the factory in Springfield. So I look forward to the day. I can't name it exactly, but I look forward to the day sometime next year when a majority of the trains on the Orange Line are new trains. So we are making progress there. And I am hopeful, again, folks on the Orange Line should be seeing those trains pretty regularly now.
So I'm going to ask you a question Solomon from Boston called in on as well, said that he wouldn't have made enough. He looked at applying to be a bus driver, wouldn't have made enough given cost of living. Can you raise wages? How much of a boogeyman is what you can afford to pay in this staffing shortage?
That's something we're looking at. I will say we just ratified, or the union just ratified, and the board just passed on this Thursday a new contract with our bus drivers union, the Carmen's Union 589, that raises wages pretty significantly to two raises of 2.5%. plus a bonus for all employees. And we are looking at the starting salary. We're also looking at doing a better job of explaining what it's like to work at the T. The average bus driver, by the time they've put in 5 years, the average salary, average base salary is around $80,000 a year. It is a job with tremendous stability and great benefits. And I think we need to do a better job of explaining that to folks. But the caller's point is well taken. We are taking a look at what that entry level salary looks like.
Okay, last sort of brief question for you. I'm thinking about 2022. I know as I look ahead in my work, I know deep in my heart what's most important to me to make sure happens next year. What is it for you?
Our first priority is always going to be safety, to make sure that we are operating the system safely, to make sure that our customers and employees are safe. So that's always going to be the priority. I think the next thing is to continue to invest in the system and invest in improving service. We want to be substantially improving service going forward. And you know, we've got a lot of ambitious plans in mid-flight, and it's bringing a bunch of those to fruition.
All right. Steve Poftek is general manager of the MBTA. Steve, always appreciate the time. Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, and thanks for having me.
So we turn now to WBUR reporter Daryl C. Murphy, who was listening in that conversation. Welcome, Daryl.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. So I know you're reporting on transportation. Let's just briefly get your reactions to what you heard from Steve Poftek.
Yeah, I think first what I'm very curious to know about is how Omicron is really impacting those changes. I think, you know, just from what I've heard, I feel like it might be a little understated, especially considering that this is a highly, highly contagious variant, you know, more contagious than the others. And I'm curious to know if they're reevaluating just how transmissible COVID is on public transportation, considering that. I mean, especially considering that a lot of health experts are asking the public to bump up their masks, right? Like now they're saying, you know, it's not just about having a cloth or double masking. Now we got to have like a specific K95 or N95 mask. So I wonder if they are really taking that into consideration, especially as they are looking to cut down the frequency of bus service on certain routes due to this worker shortage. Because, you know, when you do that, you kind of risk overcrowding, you know. And one thing I see is that the 23 and the 29 are on the list of buses to have decreased service. And, you know, these are buses that travel through neighborhoods that were identified as having been like heavily impacted by COVID-19. So I'm just curious to know if the officials at the MBTA are really taking Omicron into consideration as they have all these changes going on, you know?
So, Daryl, before we let you go, one of the things I wanted to be sure to ask you, you have fairly fresh eyes. You're relatively new to Boston by way of Philadelphia, but you reported on transportation there, too. So with your eyes, do you feel like the T has made the moves it needed to over the last year or so in the face of the pandemic? And what would you expect to see?
I think like, you know, just like when I was in Philadelphia, I think that there's things that transit agencies could do better. You know, but then there's some things that might be out of their control. You know, you can't control mass compliance without having this, you know, like without having some sort of Gestapo force on the trains, you know, or the buses. So you can't do that. But, you know, you do your best with mass compliance. But I think just keeping up with the times and making sure that you stay ahead of the curve, like I said before, you know, these variants come out and they get more and more contagious as time goes. So I just wonder if they're doing everything they can to stop it, because it does seem like they've eased up, like there's no more capacity limits. And I am very, very curious to know if they're still maintaining their cleaning practices that they had employed at the beginning of the pandemic as well. One thing I do see that the T that's positive for the T, which is coming more from the city side, is the experimentation with fare-free bus routes. But then that's also kind of clouded by the Omicron situation, because, you know, free service is going to draw more, tends to draw more riders. And so that could be a whole issue right there, you know?
Yeah, Daryl, I really appreciate that last part, because as we've talked about free T, that piece we haven't focused on. So we'll look forward to following more of your reporting in that area in the new year. WBUR reporter Daryl C. Murphy there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Holidays are just around the corner, and for many of us, that means a lot of cooking. Maybe you'll be reviving old family recipes, as we discussed on the show on Monday, or maybe experimenting with some new ones. Either way, we all can thank a 19th century Boston-born cookbook author and a domestic science pioneer who revolutionized the way recipes are replicated at home. WBUR's Andrea Shea brings us this report on the legacy of none other than Fanny Farmer.
Maybe you've heard of, tasted, or even made Parker House rolls. The iconic melt-in-your-mouth baked good was born in the late 1800s at the Boston Hotel of the same name, where today they're still being mixed, cut, and pulled out of the oven.
They are puffy and they are brown, golden, and I want to eat one now.
Omni Parker House historian Susan Wilson says the Victorian-era culinary powerhouse Fanny Farmer must have eaten these famous rolls because she figured out how to make them herself.
It wouldn't have been a big deal, even though our recipe was secret, for her to have taken it and what we would call today retro-engineer it.
That's because Farmer was a star student, then director, at the Boston Cooking School, which was just down the street. She included her Parker House roll recipe in a groundbreaking 1896 food preparation Bible called the Boston Cooking School Cookbook.
To me, Fanny Farmer is an iconic individual. We're talking about, this is, you know, more than two decades before women even have the right to vote, and she's running a cooking school, creating a book that becomes a bestseller.
It is my wish that this book may not only be looked upon as a compilation of tried and tested recipes, but that it may awaken an interest through its condensed scientific knowledge, which will lead to deeper thought and broader study of what to eat.
And the most amazing thing about Fanny Farmer is most people don't even know who she is. And yet, they're affected by what she did every single day.
Before Farmer, food historian Susan Benjamin says recipes suggested a dash of this or a teacup of that. In her book, Farmer introduced the concept of standardized level measurements.
It sounds really simple and really obvious, but it isn't, which was that you would have a certain measurement for an ingredient, say flour. You put it in a very specific kind of cup, took a knife, and you leveled it. So you had a very precise and quantifiable amount of flour in your cup.
Correct measurements are absolutely necessary to ensure the best results. Good judgment with experience has taught some to measure by sight, but the majority need definite guides.
So anyone who goes to their kitchens, takes out a measuring cup, takes out a teaspoon, follows the directions on how to use it, is doing what Fanny Farmer advocated. And that's amazing. I mean, she's the one who created this and brought it to the world.
But when Farmer set out to make the fundamentals of domestic science available to more women, her publisher was skeptical. So
she provided the upfront costs. And she also, in the process, retained the copyright. It was a wonderful seller. It was worth a fortune. And, of course, she became a very wealthy woman because of it.
The book was renegade, Benjamin says, because it applied math and science to tasks everyday women saw as drudgery. Along with hundreds of recipes, Farmer included chemical compositions of food, tables for cooking temperatures and times, photos of useful tools, and tips for reducing waste. Benjamin says Farmer didn't make success in the kitchen easy, but she made it possible and way more interesting, which was part of the domestic science movement's mission.
And this, they thought, would really empower women in every way. They would have access to the modern findings of math. They would have control over their money because they knew what to spend on food, and have control overall over the household. So it really repositioned the person who is known as the housewife.
Farmer herself never married. Not only did she transcend gender barriers, but also physical ones. As a teen, she suffered a paralytic stroke and struggled with mobility throughout her life. Just 10 days before Farmer died in 1915, at age 57, Benjamin says she was still lecturing from her wheelchair. Her grave is at Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge. The Fanny Farmer cookbook is still in print, and her Parker House roll recipe is all over the internet. During the holidays, Benjamin hopes home cooks will remember the mother of level measurements legacy.
Every Christmas dinner, you're sitting there with Fanny Farmer. Even the modern things that we eat today, they're still shaped by her and the measurements and the importance of bringing together a temperature in a stove and the amount of ingredients in a teaspoon.
And as Fanny Farmer wrote in the preface to her most famous work,
"But for life, the universe were nothing, and all that has life requires nourishment."
That report from WBUR's Andrea Shea. And as we close the show today, we want to take a moment to wish goodbye and Godspeed to Cynthia Betubiza. Cynthia's leaving us to go all in on her passion for art and photography and her work. Life's too short not to do what you're called to do. On behalf of the whole Radio Boston team, we're behind you, Cynthia. We wish you the best of luck. Thanks for helping us bring Radio Boston to our community every day. And that's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.